Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Jai.
ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Jai.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 October 5th, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam. Canto 3, Chapter 6, Creation of the Universal Form, Text 29. Tartiena Swabhavena.
Tartiena Swabhavena.
Bhagavanna Bhimashrita.
Bhagavanna Bhimashrita.
Ubayor Antaram Vyoma. Ye Rudra Parshadam Gana. Ubayo.
Ubayo.
Ubayo. Between the two.
Between the two.
Between the two.
Antaram.
Antaram.
In between.
In between.
In between.
Vyoma.
Vyoma.
The sky.
The sky.
Sky.
Yay.
Yay.
All of whom.
All of whom.
All of whom.
Rudra Parshadam.
Parshadam.
Associates of Rudra.
Associates of Rudra.
Ganaha.
Ganaha.
Population.
Population. Population.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Living entities who are associates of Rudra develop in the third mode of material nature or ignorance. They are situated in the sky between the earthly planets and the heavenly planets. Purport. The middle portion of the sky is called Bhuvarloka, as confirmed by both Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti and Srila Jiva Goswami. In Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that those who develop in the mode of passion are situated in the middle region. Those who are situated in the mode of goodness are promoted to the regions of the demigods. Those who are situated in the mode of passion are placed in human society, and those who are situated in the mode of ignorance are placed in the society of animals or ghosts. There are no contradictions in this conclusion. Numerous living entities are distributed all over the universe in different planets and are so situated in terms of their own qualities in the modes of material nature. Tartiyena Swabhavena Bhagavanna Bhimashritaha Ubayor Antaram Vyoma Ye Rudra Parshadam Ganaha. Living entities who are associates of Rudra develop in the third mode of material nature or ignorance. They are situated in the sky between the earthly planets and the heavenly planets. So this is a continuation of the point from the last verse. The last verse was that if you're in the mode of passion, you're on the earthly planets. If you're in the mode of goodness, you're on the heavenly planets. And here, if you're in the mode of ignorance, you're in Bhuvarloka. You're on the navel of the Lord. So here we have, again, body, place, and mode. For every desire, every possible desire, there is every possible material desire, there's a corresponding mode of nature, a corresponding body, and a corresponding place. So if we ask in a general way why we are here, what is the purpose of life, why does life exist, why is life the way it is, we get a general answer of rebellion against the Lord, material desires, envy, and so forth. But here's a very specific. Because we not only ask, well, why do I exist in this world? Why am I in this world? Why is anything here? But we also ask, why does this happen to me? Of course, we don't usually ask that question about things we consider good fortune. Generally speaking, you know, if somebody gives us $1 million inheritance, or we land our dream job, or we marry the person of our desire, we don't usually say, wow, what? Why has this happened to me? We tend to automatically think that we deserve it. But we do ask in life, why does this happen to me? Why has it happened to me? And a similar question is, why does it happen to others? Of course, for others, we do consider not only the bad, but also the good. There's the the book written by that rabbi, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? But although we may not like to admit it, we equally ask, why do good things happen to bad people? You know, that person is nasty, they're a cheater, they're a scoundrel. Why are they rich? Why are they famous? Why do they get a high position? Again, we don't tend to ask that question about ourselves. If I become rich, famous, and have a high position, I don't usually say, well, why has this happened to me? I don't deserve it. But when it happens to others, I ask, why is that person in a high position? Why does that person have some kind of opulence? And then we also ask, why is that person suffering? Why is that child suffering? Why did that child get beaten and killed? And why is that child born into some starving condition? Why is this good person in poverty? Why does this good person have some chronic disease? So we're asking these questions, and I suppose we don't generally ask in the modern day and age why we're on this particular planet, because the assumption is that that was sort of the only option. But according to the Vedas, that's not true. There's millions, billions of options of planets. So we can ask, why is one person living in the rich part of town and why is one person living in the poor part of the same town? In America, the way the school systems are set up, you can have in one town a very wealthy school district run by the government and a very poor school district also run by the same government because they're getting funded by property taxes. And so, if you're living one block over, you go to a good school, and if you're living one block the other way, you go to a bad school. And we can ask, why is there this disparity on this planet even? What to speak of between one planet to another? I mean, I had one gentleman arguing with me at length, saying that there was no difference between different races of people. Of course, how we define races on this planet is somewhat arbitrary. But even, forensics experts can look at a skeleton and say, well, this person was from such and such race. So there's definitely some biological differences between the races. And I tried to explain, unsuccessfully, that different types of bodies, just like different types of births, different types of planets, are all due to the same factor. And Krishna has really, really kindly, it's actually quite kindly, he has made a body, a place, and a certain combination of the modes of nature for every possible permutation, combination of desire that we can have. So if we look at the particulars of our life, all right, well, I'm a human being, but there's 400,000 species of human beings on different planets. All right, I'm a human being on the Earth planet. I'm a particular race. I'm an Aboriginal. I'm a Oriental, whatever. I'm a particular gender, male, female, and then there's also people who have mixed genders, who are ambiguous genders. Did I get born into poverty or wealth? Did I get born into an educated or uneducated family? What kind of opportunities do I have? Am I born in a beautiful place, in a terrible place? And what time in history am I born? Am I born in a different time in history? And then your life is going to be very, very different. And beyond that, we can ask, what planet am I on? In a larger question, and then the largest question is, what am I doing in the material world? And the answer to all of this comes down to our desires and our karma. And because our karma, which literally means work, is a manifestation of our desires, it really also comes down to our desires. Our desires as manifested through our activities, not just vague desires, but desires that we act on, and desires that we make some endeavor to fulfill. And of course, yam yam vapi smam bhavam, our consciousness at the time of death. And our consciousness at the time of death is indicative of our overriding strongest desire. So according to our desire, and we have many desires, right? I have many, 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 many desires. I may desire a red bicycle, or I may desire Rolls Royce, I may desire to fly in the sky. And then those combine in various ways. You can't get all of your desires in one life. That's not possible because they're contradictory. Right? If I desire both to fly and to swim, I may become a dolphin that sort of flies and swims, or a ray, a manta ray, I think they're called. They somewhat fly out of the water, a flying fish. They both fly and swim. But generally, these things are contradictory. If I want to fly, then, you know, there's certain flying creatures. If I want to swim, there's swimming creatures. If I want to do both, that may be successive lifetimes. And then, not only those desires, but the desires in terms of, again, my activities. So like Srila Prabhupada will give the example, if I'm very attached to a particular place, these verses are talking specifically about place, if I'm very attached to a particular place, I built a building, you know, Prabhupada would say you built a skyscraper, he used to call them skyscrapers. If you built a skyscraper building, and you're very attached to this building, this is my home, but if your activities are very sinful, you may only deserve to be born in that place as an insect. So if I have the desire to fly, then I also have my particular activities. So I might be a flying insect. I mean, the kids were looking at a video the other day of somebody flying in a wingsuit, and I said, oh, it looks like an insect. So, you know, when you want to fly, there's so many flying insects, mosquitoes and flies and so many entities, dragonflies that fly, butterflies, and even among the insects, such a difference between a mosquito that flies and a butterfly that flies. So much variation. So, or you could become a bird. And again, so much variation. There's vultures, there's peacocks, there's eagles, there's swans. And then, you know, if you want to fly and you have very good karma, then you could become one of the great demigods. You could become a resident of Siddhaloka. The residents of Siddhaloka fly the way that we humans on this planet walk. It's just innate to them. It naturally develops in their bodies. It's part of their innate ability. So there's this combination of my desires and my karma. And this particular combination, what I want, and you could again say it's almost the same thing because my karma is really a manifestation of what I want. So what I want puts me under a particular mode because all these material things that I want, they're all flavors of rebellion. They're all flavors of envy against Krishna. They're flavors of hatred. They're both degree and kind. So the demigods have far less envy against Krishna, and the bhutas and pisachas, and as mentioned here, the associates of Rudra, the animals, those souls, they have far more envy against Krishna. The degree is greater. Just like in ordinary crime, you know, if you break into someone's house and steal something when they're not home, that crime is not as bad as if you come in when they are home and you threaten them. If you have a weapon, it's a worse crime, right? Or there's, you know, killing somebody in the heat of an argument and killing somebody with, as they say, with malice aforethought. You plan it out, a cold-blooded murder. So one crime is worse than another. You know, raping a baby is a worse crime than raping an adult. So this is killing a police officer is a worse crime than killing an ordinary citizen. So there are degrees of criminality, there's degrees of pious life, and in the same way there's degrees of universal criminality. So you can have some envy towards God, a lot of envy towards God. You can have some envy mixed with religiousness and piety and so forth. And then there's the kind of envy that you have towards God. The specific way that you want to exhibit your envy is going to vary from one individual to another, and it's constantly changing, even for each jiva. You know, and as it changes, one gets different experience. Well, let me try envying God in this way. Let me try envying God in that way. And for each of these envies of God, and this is perhaps the most important point, is that one has to get covered by a particular mode of nature. Because envy of God is impossible in knowledge. It's impossible. For the uncovered soul to act in envy of God is impossible. As soon as one has that desire, one has to become covered in order to experience that desire. The uncovered soul just can't do it. the uncovered soul will immediately see the greatness of God and the insignificance of their self, and they won't be able to maintain that desire. So if the living entity wants to maintain that desire, just like Hiranyakashipu, he was angry at the Lord for his whole life, which is very astonishing. Most of us don't maintain anger at somebody for our entire life. Some people do, obviously. Some people maintain anger at somebody over many, 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 many lifetimes. But the uncovered soul who sees the reality of God and sees the reality of himself. Now, this is not just someone who sees God, because we have demons who see God and maintain their envy. They see God and say they want to kill him. But they don't really see him as he is. Like Duryodhana, he sees Krishna, he sees the universal form, but he doesn't really see this as God. So the soul who sees God can certainly envy God. There's plenty of evidence of that. But the soul who sees God as he is and sees himself as he is cannot possibly maintain an envy of God. There has to be a covering. And Krishna is so kind that he gives the soul a covering according to their very specific desires, and that covering changes from life to life in a very gross way, and it can change to some extent within a lifetime. So within a lifetime, one can change one's modes of nature, certainly, but you're sort of stuck with the general swabhava of that lifetime. You know, changing your modes within a lifetime is going to have a lot more effect on your future body than on your present body. You know, you're not going to be able to change from a demon to a demigod within one lifetime, or from an animal to a human, or, you know, from a human to an animal. I mean, you can act like an animal, but you can't literally change into an animal. You're going to have some kind of human consciousness in that lifetime. So we get a particular covering of the modes, and that particular covering of the modes then goes, as we were saying before, the creation goes from subtle to gross. It then gives one a particular body, a particular life story, a particular family, and a particular place. And in that place, one is going to be associated with other people who are also in similar combinations of that mode. No one's going to have exactly the same combination of the modes, but something very similar to oneself. We have this ganaha. Ganaha, which Prabhupada's translating as population, but also means group. One's going to be in a group of people with similar consciousness. Now, it's interesting here, Rudra Parshadam, associates of Rudra. Rudra means the expansions of Lord Shiva. It also means anger. And here we see that those who are in the mode of ignorance, they themselves are filled with anger. They're in a place that's full of anger. Their associates are full of anger. So why would one be in a place and with entities who are similarly covered? Well, first of all, that's what we want. And to be in a place and with entities who are similarly covered, it helps us to remain covered in that particular way. Right? It sort of prevents one from, as we say nowadays, thinking outside of the box. So if one is in a particular combination of goodness, passion, ignorance, and one's associates are in a very similar combination, then that's what's going to seem normal to oneself. One will think, yes, this is the way things are. This is the way that we think. You know, if people are born into a group of, you know, racists or nationalists or fanatics, and they just think this is the truth. That's the lens through which they see the world. You know, if you're born into a family of meat eaters, then you think, well, this is what we eat. Meat eating is natural. And when you're in a particular society, then you're less likely to change. You're less likely to have your beliefs challenged. And this is, of course, what the jiva wants. The jiva wants, I want to fulfill these particular desires, and therefore that Krishna puts them in a situation, matasmatir ganam apohanam cha, where they're likely to fulfill their desires because no one's going to challenge their paradigm. You're surrounded by people with the same paradigm, and you grow up feeling that this is just it, this is what it is. You know, if you are lower than a human being, then that's a very deep thing. You know, we are dogs and we act like this. Occasionally, there are stories in the animal world of some orphaned animal that gets raised by another species and gets very confused as to what they should eat and what they should do and how they should behave. There's even some stories of humans who get raised by animals like that. And of course, there's stories of people from one culture, one race, who get raised by people of another culture in another race, and they have this sort of interesting life. But in general, we're in a situation where the way we think is just normal. We don't even know that it's a covering. We don't notice that it's a covering. We don't notice that we're under the modes of nature. If you're very angry and you're with other people, other entities who are we're also very angry, then anger is just normal. You're not even really aware that you're angry. I remember when I first started chanting Hare Krishna, staying at the ashram. This is before I moved in full-time, but I was staying for a couple weeks. And I wasn't even at that point chanting 16 rounds. I was really a visitor. I was chanting a little. I was going to the morning program, taking prasadam. And I remember all of a sudden noticing how the people at work and the people in the world were constantly in a state of fear. It was so fascinating to me, because up until that point, I hadn't noticed that at all. I had just thought that was the way it is. I remember also when I became a vegetarian at the devotees' urging, and some lifetime, up till then, lifetime health problems, of course I was very young, but still, they disappeared. And what was fascinating to me was I had thought that the problems I had with my health were actually normal. I didn't see them as problems. I didn't see them as things that shouldn't be there. I just thought, well, that's the way the body works. You know, it's something like my father didn't get glasses till he was 19, till he took a driving test. And then all of a sudden he realized that up till then he couldn't see. I know someone recently who got glasses at 14. And also, he hadn't realized up till then that he couldn't see what other people could see. He said it was one time he heard his father talking about something and saying, oh, somebody can see that? He said he had thought before then, well, if you're looking at a stage and the faces are blurry, of course they're blurry, they're far away. And all of a sudden he realized, wait a minute, there's something wrong with my eyes. Right? So it's like that in our association, in our place, that we just think this is the way it is. We think being full of fear or being full of anger or being full of lust or being full of greed, you know, that's reality. It becomes our normal. Something like, I've given this example before, that, you know, if there's a certain noise in your environment or a certain smell in your environment, it becomes background. You don't notice it. You know, here we have these frogs that make a lot of noise at night. The first night you're here, you can't sleep, and after that, you don't even notice them anymore. They just fade into the background. After you're here for a couple months, you really don't hear them at all. You just don't notice them. We had a house where there was a train in the backyard, and, you know, we forgot after the first couple nights, we forgot it was there. I had some guests one time from California. We were sitting on the deck of the house talking, and as the train went by, we just stopped talking. And after it left, they looked at me and said, how can you be so calm in an earthquake? Because in California, they have lots of earthquakes. And I said, no, that was a train. Right? So whatever is part of our environment, especially if everyone is like that, becomes our normal. And this way we're called conditioned souls. And it's very hard to get out of that paradigm, because one doesn't even understand that it's a paradigm. One doesn't even understand that it's an artificial system of beliefs about reality. One thinks it is reality. And this point is something that's very hard to understand. Our beliefs about what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad, what's normal and what's abnormal, are so deeply rooted in us in any particular lifetime that we don't even know they are our beliefs. We think they simply are. We think they're simply true. And we don't question whether or not they're true. If we meet somebody who doesn't believe that they're true, we think there's something wrong with them. Of course, in our modern world in 2015, there becomes a lot of mixing of persons. These verses are talking about places within the universe, different places in the universe. And even within a planet, as we said, there's different places on the planet. And nowadays, there's a lot more mixing. There's a lot more mixing in terms of actual travel. You know, when I was a little girl, for someone to travel across the ocean, they generally went by ship. I mean, I remember being in a propeller plane that crossed the Atlantic when I was 3. But very few people traveled, you know, and to make a trip was a big thing, a 3-week journey there, a 3-week journey back. Nowadays, travel is very common. But even for people who don't travel, you travel via the media, and one's exposed to different cultures via the media. And in many countries, not in all, but in many countries, there's a heterogeneous mix of different cultures and races and backgrounds and ways of thinking in the same place. And we must say that as long as one is in material consciousness, this kind of mixing simply escalates conflict. So if people remain in their particular mode of nature and they remain in their particular paradigm, then having people with all different combinations of modes and all different paradigms mix with each other creates conflict and war and crime, because your paradigm is so different from my paradigm, and it's so much of a threat to me, and I'm so much of a threat to you, that we seek to annihilate one another. And you'll notice in a lot of these conflicting paradigms, the other is an enemy. You know, I remember when I was, I guess, 12 or 13, and I was raised in a Jewish family, and I met one Christian girl who said, "Do you accept Christ as the Messiah?" And I said, "No, I accept him as a prophet, not as the Messiah." And she said, "Oh, you're a heathen." So, you know, everyone has this name for the other, someone who has a different paradigm of life, and that there's something wrong with the people who have the other paradigm. And there's an effort to try to counteract this escalating conflict throughout the world due to these clashes of paradigms with multiculturalism, saying, you know, well, everyone's different paradigm is okay for them, and what's good for you is just good for you, and what's good for them is just good for them. And in one sense, there's truth to that, in the sense that everybody is in their perfect situation according to their karma and desires. In another sense, though, it isn't true, because different people's karma and desires is better or worse. The demigod's view of reality, the paradigm of the demigods, is much more accurate than the paradigm of a human being. The way that the demigods view reality is a lot closer to what reality is than the way that we view reality. And the way that we humans view reality is much closer to how reality is than the way that the demons and the pisaches and the animals view reality. So multiculturalism doesn't take into, or also called post-positivism, post-modernism, it doesn't take into account that there is some absolute truth, and that we have degrees and kinds of covering. Just to say that all degrees and kinds of covering are good for those particular individuals doesn't really address the actual problem. And therefore we find that attempts toward multiculturalism haven't solved this inner conflict. So of course, we in the Hare Krishna movement, we as followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada, we are seeking to challenge all of the materialistic paradigms. We are seeking to challenge the root of the whole business. And whether one is in goodness, passion, ignorance, whether one is black, white, or green, or purple, or male, or female, or intersex, or whether one's on the earth planet, or the heavenly planets, or anywhere, we're saying, hey, get rid of the root of this whole thing. Get rid of this envy of God and become Jivaraswar Bhaya Krishna Nityadasha. Become again a servant of God. Only then can one become completely uncovered. Only then will one have complete freedom. And anything else is simply one kind of covering. Or not. Oh, my kind of covering is better than your kind of covering. Oh, okay. Maybe. But we're all still covered. Just like Prabhupada said, you know, the first class prisoner and the third class prisoner. So to be in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison is certainly worse than to be able to play, you know, tennis in a minimum security prison. But prison is still prison. Prison is still prison. So we, as followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we don't discriminate. We don't say to someone, okay, what kind of maya are you in? What kind of covering do you have? And Prabhupada often says that this Krishna consciousness movement is meant for the whole universe, and that Krishna appears in every species. So those who are followers of the Lord, they don't say, oh, you have to be a demigod, or you can't, you whatever you are. Even animals, we chant the holy name. Even to the plants, we chant the holy name. And once one gives up the root of the envy, once one gives up this root of envy, once one starts to give up this root of envy, then the coverings diminish, because the covering of the modes is in response to our envy. Mamchayo vyavicharina bhakti yogina sevate sadhunan samatityaitam brahma buddhaya kalpate. As we serve Krishna without interruption and without motivation, then our envy starts to decrease. Because it's not just a question of seeing God. The demons also see God. It's a question of serving God. It's a question of having love rather than envy. And as we build our love and our envy decreases, then the coverings of the modes over our consciousness go away. And we start to see our paradigms for what they are. Paradigms. We start to see them as simply false belief systems about the nature of reality. Every conditioned soul has a whole set of false belief systems about the nature of reality, and those false belief systems allow them to continue to maintain their false ego. So we start seeing them for what they are. We see them as false. We see them as harmful. And as we see them like that, we become disgusted with them. And then Krishna, Ridyantasta Bhadrani Vijanoti Suritsita. And Krishna removes that covering from our heart. Of course, one still has the body. We need the body to execute our service on a practical level. Until we're completely purified, we still have our particular body. And our particular body means the family we were born into and so many things. It's not that when our envy ceases, all of a sudden that external goes away. And because that external is still there, one may still serve the Lord in a particular way, according to the swabhava, we have that word being used here, of the body. Because what happens is, when one's envy goes, then one sees something else. We've been talking extensively about how our body and our place is according to our modes, which is according to our desire. But another point is being made here in this section, because the name of this chapter is the creation of the universal form. And the main point here is that all these different kinds of entities have a place according to their desire, their modes, etc., but also a place in the Lord's body. So here we have this Ubayor Antaram Vyoma. They are in the middle of the sky. Nabim Bhagavan, Nabim Ashritaha. I find this line amazing. So we have, if we look closely at the Sanskrit, Tartyena Swabhavena. If your swabhava, if your mode is in ignorance, then Bhagavan Nabim Ashritaha. Ashrita is a shelter. You have shelter in the Lord's navel. If you're in the mode of ignorance, you have shelter in the Lord's navel. And what does that mean? Uvayor Antaram Vyoma. It means you're in the middle portion of the sky. Ye Rudra Parshadam Gana. And you have other associates who are filled with anger. So even though you're in the mode of ignorance, even though you have other associates that are filled with anger, you get to be in the Lord's navel. You have the shelter of the Lord's navel. All of us are in the universal body of the Lord. No matter what place that we have, we're still in the universal body of the Lord. Parents who have many children, so they may give each child different kinds of lessons. One gets violin lessons, one gets martial arts lessons. One gets singing lessons, one gets art lessons. They may have different rooms of the house. They're going to have different clothing. One child likes to wear red, one child likes to wear yellow. But they're all in the home of the parents. They're all in the home of the parents. So all of us, whatever place we have, according to our modes, according to our desire, we all have a place in the universal body of the Lord. Therefore, one who gets rid of this root of envy, one who starts chipping away, which is what we're doing in bhakti yoga, we're chipping away at this envy, we're replacing envy. Perhaps a better model would be that we're dissolving it. Prabhupada would use the word dissolving you know, we're pouring prema from the lotus feet of the pure devotees. We're pouring this prema over this hard core of envy in our heart. And the prema is replacing the envy. It's driving the envy away. And as the envy gets driven away, then we start to see, this is such an important point, we start to see our particular body, our particular family, our particular nature, our particular place, not so much as a fulfillment of our material desires, but as what place do I have in the Lord's body. Such an important point. There are even devotees, we have to speak frankly, there are even devotees who say that the main thing that we should do with our particular body and situation is fulfill our duties in the world of varna and ashram. But our duties in the world of varna and ashram are mostly to allow us to have a pious way of fulfilling our material desires. But one who's dissolving this envy in the heart starts to see, wait a minute, there's a way that this particular body can be used in service to the Lord. And this is the situation with Arjuna. Krishna said to him, you have a particular nature. Of course, Arjuna is a liberated soul, but the model is good. The model is relevant for us. Krishna is saying to Arjuna, you have a particular nature. You have this particular body and circumstances due to your past deeds and your past karma. And that's not going to change, not in this life. But what you can do is you can remove the root reason why you got this body in this situation. You can change your consciousness. You can see the truth rather than viewing the world through a lens of a particular combination of the modes. And once you see the truth, then you can see that it's more true that this body and situation has a place in the form of the Lord than that it's designed for your own pleasure. Because after all, if it's really the property of the Lord, it's ultimately designed for the Lord's pleasure. And when one does that, one doesn't change the nature of one's body in this life, or the nature of one, you know, that's fixed for this life. But one uses it very differently. I was just hearing the other day, Prabhupada was talking about adding one to zeros. You know, you have a zero, you put a one in front of it, it becomes 10. You have 100, you have two zeros, you put a one in front of it, it becomes 100. Whatever situation we have, it has some utilization in the service of the Lord. There's something we can do. Jatayu, who was a vulture, served the Lord. If a vulture has a place in the service of the Lord, what to speak of the rest of us? So our question becomes, how can I use what I have to serve the Lord? Not how can I change what I have. How can I change what I have simply brings me to another body, where I'll get another set of situations. Yes, my situation is due to my envious desires. It's a fact. But the Lord is so kind that he has all of those varieties of envious desires within his own body, that we can function as a part of his body. No. Whatever I am going through, it is a result of my previous desires. It is just, it is fair, it is perfect. Now let me make the best use of a bad bargain. Whatever it is. You can say, well, I can understand how to use wealth in Krishna service. How do I use poverty in Krishna service? I can see how to use health in Krishna service. How do I use illness in Krishna service? I can see how to use a family favorable to Krishna consciousness in Krishna service. How do I use a family unfavorable to Krishna consciousness in Krishna service? But you know, all those models are there. They're there throughout the Bhagavatam. They're there throughout Chaitanya Charitamrita. They're there in our recent history of ISKCON. People who've used all varieties of bodies, shy bodies, outgoing, you know, shy natures, outgoing natures, male, female, crippled, abled, whatever, intelligent, handicapped. All these things have a place in the body of the Lord. As our circumstances change in this life, which they inevitably do, we use each of, how does this fit in with the body of the Lord? How does this fit in with the body of the Lord? And then, when we start seeing our place like that, when we start seeing, oh, I have a place here, I have shelter, Bhagavan Navim Ashritaha, I have shelter in the Lord's name, I have shelter in the Lord's body, then guess what place we get? We get a place in the Lord's abode when we start thinking like that now. When we give up our all of our envious, angry paradigms now, then we end up in the Lord's original abode. We end up not just within the universal form and in Maya, but we end up in the Lord's abode. So that is our purpose of our Hare Krishna movement. We're not a sectarian religion. We're looking to remove the coverings of envy and come to the light of truth. So questions, comments?
A comment. You mentioned that the example, sometimes a human is raised, you find them raised by animals. And I was just sort of, the thought ran through my mind that since when we define human life as one who is endeavoring for perfection, the Tattva Brahma Jigyasa, that's where human life actually starts, that for all intents and purposes in this world, if a child is born in a non-devotee family, he's really raised by animals. And all of his models and all of his training is based on how to survive as an animal within this world, not as a human. And how fortunate we were when we, it's like Prabhupada rescued us from living with animals. But a question crossed my mind that's a little bit oblique to the class, but from the same thing. Are there really examples of children that were raised by animals that you know of?
Yes, there are.
Can you elaborate at all?
I'd have to look it up, but yes, there are examples. They're called,
okay.
They're called feral children. And there's not many examples, but yes, there are examples.
Somehow I find it interesting, want to know more.
You can certainly research it. I mean, it happens sometimes in war. You know, everybody's killed and there's only a young child. And it ends up getting sheltered by animals. I mean, it happens in the animal kingdom that animals will sometimes rear an offspring of a very different species. Sometimes animals will even rear the offspring of a species they would normally eat. You know, it's unusual, but it does happen. It does happen. And it certainly is very rare, but it happens. There are human children raised by humans, but without any human contact. And there are also instances of human children raised by animals. When those children are found too late, like too mature, they never fully integrate into human society. I can't remember the name. There was one boy like that, and he had remarkable physical abilities. I know he could, the researchers who were studying him found that he could take potatoes out of boiling water, put his hands into the boiling water, not get burnt, for example. So that sometimes they develop different, you know, abilities. But anyway, yes, it does happen. Rarely, but it does happen.
I think it's interesting. I guess it's also true that if we get rescued sometimes too late, it seems like it's often easier for someone who's a little young and a little more open-minded to take to Krishna consciousness than someone who's old, a little set in their ways. I guess that's not always true.
Well, that's not absolutely true, because spiritual life is there in every living entity, whereas, you know,
right,
language development and cultural development tends to have a certain window of opportunity. A lot of these feral children never fully develop language at all. Their language development becomes stunted. So there may be certain windows of opportunity for some material. But yeah, even spiritually. I mean, Prabhupada was asked, why are so many of your followers young? And he said, because youth is the time for education. You know, one of the factors of human life which distinguishes it not only from animal life, but also from demigod life, is our very, 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 very long childhood. So there just aren't other creatures who have this long childhood. You read in the Bhagavatam about the demigod children, you know, they grow up immediately. They mature very quickly. They don't have a long childhood. question. And if you want to question what is the value of this long childhood of the human species, besides being a source of both amusement and austerity for the parents, it's so that you have a chance to be molded. Prabhupada said children are like a blank slate. And our paradigms of life are very strongly formed in our childhood. And it's, you know, there are some things that are just karma, like there's a lot of experiments done or studies done of identical twins who were separated at birth and adopted into different families, and they do find that nature trumps nurture. They do find that these identical twins have more in common with each other than the families in which they were raised. There was a story recently in the New York Times of two sets of identical twins in some South American country, and that were born at the same time in the same hospital, and two of the babies got switched, so that each family went home with what they thought were fraternal twins. So they went home with one child who was genetically theirs, and another child that was genetically somebody else's. And each of these boys had an identical twin in the other family. One of the families was very wealthy, lived in the city. One of the families was very poor, lived in the country as farmers. And it was really interesting when these boys, as young adults, found each other, and they discovered, again, that they had, in many ways, more in common with their genetic twin than they did with their birth family. So, you know, even for human beings, this fact is one reason why in Vedic times they were so interested in who marries whom and in doing different samskaras. Because if you're very careful to let only people of the same nature marry, you know, man and woman should marry only if they have the same swabhava, only if they have the same nature. And then in addition to that, they did various yajnas and samskaras and rituals to bring a child who was of the same nature. And the story with Parasuram and Jamadagni is very instructive in this regard. Someone has a lot of fear, don't they? So, you know, there's a limit as to how much you can mold a human child. They are coming in with their own swabhava, which is the dominant factor. At the same time, it is possible with a human being particularly to mold them. And therefore, spiritual instruction, Krishna conscious instruction to children in the world. Can we mute whoever has all that static? Krishna conscious instruction to children is so important. It's so important. Prabhupada says you can mold a child till they're 16. And he says they're like soft dough. So I think of it like, you know, you're making something out of dough, any of you who cook, you know, and you can put the dough into any shape you like, but once you bake it, the only way to change the shape is to break it, to cut it. So once we become baked, it's much harder. Of course, you know, we have both those things, that Krishna consciousness is not dependent on our particular circumstance, and that childhood training in Krishna consciousness is so important to get that paradigm, you know, the paradigm that there's a God, God is a person, we're all spirit souls, and so forth. I mean, for example, I've noticed that children who are trained nicely in Krishna consciousness have no concept of racism. It's just not there. They're not a prejudice according to the body like that. So it's something that happens at a very, very young age. You know, they'll be 2 years old and they go to the different creatures and say, you know, high spirit soul and so forth. Okay, anybody else?
Mother-in-law, I saw a short film on YouTube. It was amazing. Somebody had photographed this, it was a lion, that had adopted a calf and was protecting it even from other lions, tigers, anyway, whatever. And you know, that I found that quite curious. I'm sure you're aware of this in the third verse of the Bhagavatam. There's that statement that Prabhupada makes that rasa can only be exchanged between members of the same species.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question. I've really never been able to reconcile that because, you know, if you have a pet, it really seems like you have affection. You're exchanging affection with that pet. Mm. So when I saw this, you know, lion, tiger, I forget what it was. But anyway, you know, licking and protecting this calf. What does Prabhupada mean by...
You know, that's a statement of Srila Prabhupada's that I've also found sort of inconceivable. What exactly does he mean? I wish somebody had asked him. I can tell you what my own understanding is, that when we become Krishna conscious, there's no set question of different species. Right? Pandita Samadarshinaha Vijavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hasane Suni Chavas Sapake Cha Pandita Samadarshinaha. So if you have people who are Krishna conscious, then rasa can be exchanged because you're not exchanging on the material level. But if you're in your species consciousness, then your paradigms are so different, your lenses are so different, that what you think you're exchanging, you're not exchanging. Because rasa is... both people are experiencing a similar rasa. Whereas, like, let's say you have a dog. Your dog is not experiencing its relationship with you anywhere close to how you're experiencing your relationship with the dog. Your awareness, your consciousness, your interpretation of your relationship is completely different. And I'm sure it's that way with a tiger and calf and so forth and so on. You know, obviously among the animals, that sort of interspecies relationship is unusual. It's sort of against the norm. I mean, you have certain species, as Prabhupada mentions in the previous purport, that are habituated to relating with human beings. And we could consider those higher levels of animals, that they're almost part of human society. It was explained in the previous verse. They're followers of human beings. So the domesticated animals, they do have some relationship with human beings. But definitely the way your dog sees you and the way you see your dog seeing you are not the same. You know, people like having dogs so that one reason is so the dog greets them when they come home. You know, you can find, I'm sure, thousands and thousands of videos on the internet of somebody being greeted by a dog. You know, the soldier coming home and being greeted by the dog. And I was studying about why do the dogs do that? You know, why do they jump up and lick your face? And that goes back to their ancestry as wolves, and it goes back to how they communicate among the wolf pack and so forth and so on. And so what the dog is doing by licking your face is not what you think they're doing. They have a different mentality. So I see it somewhat like that, that when you have this interspecies relationship, it's not... there's not actually rasa going on. I mean, in a sense, even between members of the same species, if we're all conditioned, there's not real rasa going on. Therefore, Kunti said, break this bondage of my family affection. And Prabhupada says, seeing in the dark is not seeing, but seeing in the light is seeing. And when there's a relationship of soul to soul via the super soul, only then is there a real relationship. So I can have only a real relationship, a genuine relationship with another jiva, if it's Krishna-centered. If it's not Krishna-centered, then I'm false and they're false. My mask is relating with your mask. You know, it's something like a computer game where my character in the computer game is relating with your character in the computer game. But as neither of those are our real self, the relationship that we have between our characters is not a genuine relationship. It just isn't. You know, if I'm in a drama and you're in the drama, you know, like I played Jed Barrett's stepmother in a drama in Mayapur. So, you know, there was this one second-generation devotee who's playing Jed Barrett. So I'm not his stepmother. That's not my relationship with him. So in the drama, we had a particular relationship that appeared to evoke particular rasa between us and between us and the audience. But it was false. I mean, because it was Krishna Leela, that's another thing. But if it was a mundane Leela, it would be false. It's not the real relationship. You know, people who are really into media, movies and TV shows and the so-called rasa that they're feeling is all an illusion. Those people are not. They're just actors. So we're all actors. It's so stupid. we're just acting. I'm your husband, I'm your wife, I'm your mother, I'm your father. It's just an act influenced by the modes of nature. So who's really interacting? So I see, and then when you get to interspecies, it's even more pronounced that the coverings are so different that how I'm under, I mean, we've even experienced with human, this with human beings, even on the material level, that I think the relationship is one thing. And maybe this is particularly pronounced with young teenagers who imagine that someone is attracted to them when they're not. They misinterpret their behavior. And I was reading that men are more likely to misinterpret women's behavior than women to misinterpret men in terms of, are you attracted to me? You know, we make up a story about their behavior that doesn't match their behavior. And this happens to us all the time. That we think that somebody hates us and they don't. We think someone likes us and they don't. We think somebody feels this way about us and they actually don't. We're misappropriating, misinterpreting their feelings and their intentions. And this is one of our common problems. So if such is true even with another human being, if such is true even with another human being in our family or close circle, how much is it going to be true between species? So that's how I understand it. But I do wish that someone had asked Prabhupada that and that he had answered it himself.
No, that's a very good explanation. That makes sense to me. Thank you.
Sure. Anybody else?
Just a thought. You had said, and I was meditating on it since you mentioned it, about how only here in this human society we have this incredibly long childhood.
Yeah.
We're so dependent upon the parents. But that's not necessarily the case with the demigods.
No.
And I was thinking, well, perhaps that sheds some light on the fact that Dhruva, who was, his lila was during the Satya Yuga.
Yeah.
Maybe it sheds some light on the fact that he, at 5 years old, was able to, with such determination, to leave home, go to the forest, and approach Narada Muni and engage in the incredible austerities that he engaged in at the age of five.
Well,
it's not like a five-year-old child in this age.
I would certainly agree with you. You know, the human body, I mean, we have the story of Muchukunda in the cave and how he came out of the cave and he was gigantic and he saw that all the trees and all the human beings were pygmy-sized. You know, even the scientists find evidence that creatures were much bigger in former ages. And when Krishna told him, just go do austerities, you know, you can wait for another life. And the acharyas say it's because he couldn't fit this giant man into his lila. I mean, it's interesting. There's this story in Gopal Champu about Balaram and Revati. How when Revati comes to marry Balaram, she's huge. She and her father are giants because they're from another age of the earth. They had gone up to Lord Brahma's planet. And they come back and they're huge. And everyone's asking, you know, actually her father, Kukundi, forget his name, he had asked Lord Brahma, you know, how is my daughter going to marry Balaram? Balaram's appearing like a human of the end of Dwarpara Yuga, and we're from Satya Yuga. And Balaram said, don't worry, Balaram, Brahma said, don't worry, Balaram will take care of it. And also when they came to Dwarka, everyone was asking that question. And Krishna said to Balaram, just take care of it. And Jiva Goswami says that while she was sleeping, Balaram took his plow and altered her limbs mystically to give her a suitable body for the time. So that even on this earth planet and other yugas, the bodies are much, much bigger, much, much stronger physically, much, much stronger mentally. You know, like we try to meditate for 5 minutes, it's a huge austerity. In Satya Yuga, they could meditate for 10,000 years without deviating their mind. Their health was much better. And yes, of course, their capability was much stronger. I mean, the human beings in other ages are almost like what we think about as demigods at the present time. You know, just imagine what the demigod bodies are like. Just imagine what the spiritual bodies are like. Okay, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.